Thank you so much for listening to Urbanistica podcast. I am Mustafa Sharif, an urban planner, and you're more than welcome to join my big journey of exploring the making of smarter and more livable cities. Please don't forget to follow Urbanistica on the different social media platforms, and also let's connect on LinkedIn. Big thanks to Urbanistica podcast partner, Avery. Avery is an international engineering and design company providing sustainable solutions in the fields of energy, industry, and infrastructure. Are you ready for a new episode? Let's go for it. So hello and welcome, Nicholas.
Thank you. Hey.
How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Very fine. Happy to be here. Thanks for the confidence inviting me.
My pleasure. So how was your day?
Oh, not too bad. Woke up at the hotel this morning. I was in Channel 4 talking about that it is now 3 years since we had the first COVID case in Sweden. And we have created something called the Virus and Pandemic Foundation. And we have started something that's called Pandemic Day, the day of the pandemic, because of this. So we talk about our learnings then.
So should we celebrate today? What should we say?
we can for sure celebrate, not like that we have had the pandemic and everything terrible that has happened, but we can celebrate that I think that we have the worst behind us.
Yeah.
And I see, I may be wrong, but I think that we can soon say that the pandemic is over and that we have everything behind us.
Yeah, yeah.
So that is worth celebrating.
That's the good news.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yes.
So can you tell us more about yourself? How would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, okay. So, I'm working at Umeå University, professor of virology there, and sort of founder, one can say maybe, board member of the Swedish Society of Virology that has started the Virus and Pandemic Foundation. And as a person, I sometimes think of myself at least as a little bit naive. and with that, I think it can also be an asset, not understanding how challenging and hard things can be, because then one wouldn't start them up. But so that is something good, I think. But also a bit stubborn and what else can I say? Optimistic.
That's very needed.
Yeah, these are, I value these sort of characteristics.
Yeah, but the foundation, is it a public or how is it financed?
This Swedish Society for Virology is a non-profit organization that has been around for 20 years almost. And now we just started this activity. Mm. So it's an activity, one can say, the Virus and Pandemic Foundation that try to raise funding from public, from companies, get visibility from organizations so that we can share our ambitions, our missions, and so we can strengthen the research in this area so that research can contribute knowledge and tools to healthcare and society.
Yeah, we just talked also about the importance of you sharing the knowledge and the results. So tell us about this more.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So sometimes one feels that when you're working at the university, sort of also until the pandemic, it was okay. So we do research, we publish, and we teach med students, for example. But the research that we do and publish in scientific journals, it's quite rare that we communicate these kind of things. And it's quite rare that we talk about the consequences of virus-caused infections to the general public, to public health and healthcare and so on. But now during the pandemic, it has become quite evident that these things cause challenges and problems to everyone. We have had lots of questions over these 3 years. So I feel also that this is important. We need to communicate about, talk about these kind of things to a much higher extent than we have done previously.
Yeah, and just now you were on the TV, the Swedish TV.
Exactly.
How was it?
It was okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. They are very professional, the journalists that ask the questions. That makes me feel comfortable. So this was 10 minutes questions about what our learnings are. So it was okay.
Are you used now to talk on media, newspaper, compared to what before COVID?
Definitely. Much. I feel much more comfortable. The first interviews that I did in the beginning of the pandemic, they were really shitty. Really shitty. Yeah, so I had so much to say, but I couldn't formulate myself. But I feel that that has improved.
Because you need to be very clear and precise and short, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right.
Do you find it difficult?
In the beginning, it was.
Yeah.
When I didn't have like thought everything that about everything that I wanted to say, but now I know what to say, and I've said it quite a number of times, so I feel much more comfortable. So short is important.
Yeah. So you learn the skills like how to summarize a very big paper or research to like very few sentences.
Yeah, that can be done too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So you mentioned that today is the day when the first case in Sweden, right?
Yes.
And how was it? Like, how can you tell us about it?
Yeah. So my own reflections about was it that, okay, so it was expected that it would come to Sweden also. And I remember thinking also comparing with the two other outbreaks caused by other types of coronaviruses. Mm. And those viruses had like a mortality of 10 and 30% respectively, which meant that, and at that time we didn't know about the mortality, how dangerous the new virus was. So at that time, I was really scared. We didn't know what would be the consequences, how bad. We knew that it would be bad, but not how bad. I remember that. I was a bit afraid.
Yeah. And when we got the first case here in Sweden, did you imagine that, okay, this is going to be very dark the coming years?
Yeah, I feared about that. We didn't know what to expect because it was the first coronavirus caused pandemic that we have experienced. So we didn't really know what to expect. No.
Okay.
Not in modern time. Mm-hmm. So we knew about some other coronaviruses that caused like a common cold, basically. And they have come from somewhere before.
Yeah.
So they have caused like outbreaks of pandemics when they were introduced in humanity. That was hundreds of years ago.
Yeah.
So this was the first time in modern times. So we didn't know what to expect.
Yeah.
That was also a bit scary.
Yeah, I can imagine. But do you have it in mind, like if this was a senior or like a, I don't know, traveler or like who was the person
that brought it to Sweden? Yeah. So
yeah. How did we get it?
It was a person who came from Wuhan in China.
Okay.
And she felt ill.
Mm-hmm.
And she behaved very well when she came to Sweden because she felt, okay, now I'm coming back from Wuhan and I don't feel well. So she isolated herself directly and called healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And healthcare could take the precautions that they needed to limit the transmission from her.
Yeah.
So there were probably no transmission from her.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason to why we had more transmission later on was not because of her, but because of others.
Yeah. So we're going to talk a lot about the learning and so on. But like during the 3 years, what did you do in the foundation?
Yeah, so we started the foundation maybe 2 years ago because we felt, okay, so we need to create something that can do more for society and healthcare. We need to do more research.
Yeah.
The virology research area is historically a little bit small because it's a quite new research area as compared to other infectious diseases. So we aren't that many researchers. So we thought, okay, we need to be more researchers that can or good for healthcare. So we started the Virus and Pandemic Foundation. So we contacted the Swedish Collection Control.
Mm-hmm.
That is like a quality stamp for nonprofit organizations, and we became a member there. There's also another organization in Swedish called Giva Sverige, mm-hmm. Giving Sweden, also like an organization that provides a quality stamp to nonprofit organizations. And from there we started. And contacted like companies, some other foundations for support to see what we could do, what we could get. And we were like beginners in this. We didn't have any experience. And we didn't have any money to start with.
How many were you in the team?
So we have this society with this board. Uh-huh. And it was like maybe me and one more person that took the initial initiative.
Yeah.
To start with this, and his name is Johan Nordgren. He's a researcher also at Linköping University, and the two of us has now been the most active, I would say, starting up all this. And we contacted some other people asking for like volunteers and so on, and we applied for some money to start with from the Knut and Alice Wallenberg Foundation.
Yeah.
And we asked for like 200,000 to start with.
It's not so big.
No,
so
no
big
that's
money.
Right. Yeah, but we had like a budget and some ideas. Yeah. We didn't want to ask for too much. But the funny thing is that when they got back to us, they gave us like 700,000.
Ah, okay.
So they gave us more than we asked for. Yeah, that's good. So we were super happy, like, and so on. And later we have applied for more money from this foundation, and they supported us with another 3 million.
Wow.
Yeah. So this is like the basis. For the work that we do right now.
Yeah.
And initially we talked with some other companies, like big pharma companies. They didn't know about us. They didn't know where they had us, what was our ambition and so on. But now they know us a little bit better.
We have established.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So we have established relations and so on. So now it feels like they want to support us.
But what are you going to do the research on? There's no more pandemic, right?
There will be, yeah, okay. So this pandemic will hopefully be over soon, but
the
World Health Organization has announced no less than 7 global public health emergencies during the latest 14 years.
Okay.
All of these have been caused by different viruses.
Yes.
So we can expect or fear that there will be more global emergencies being announced, being declared by the World Health Organization. They will be caused by viruses, and there will be more pandemics in future. So we need to prepare for that.
But do we know what kind of viruses, or we just know that there these areas or this like there will be a pandemic within this area?
Yeah, there will be more virus caused pandemics. Okay. We know that. So we have to prepare for it.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about the preparation for the coming pandemics. Tell me more about like the key learning from this COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah. So I think one can divide that into two answers. First of all, the national perspective. What have we learned in Sweden? And then I think one can think of it as a global perspective. So if we start with the Swedish perspective, we know that our healthcare is very, very fragmented. So we have like 21 different counties, we have different cities, we have a private sector and so on, which means they don't really have the computer systems that communicate with.
No, each one has separated systems.
Exactly. And whenever they do procurements and buy, for example, safety equipment and so on, they have to do it independently, which complicates things very much and makes healthcare sometimes also a bit unequal. So that is one thing when it comes to the national perspective. On a global perspective, and I think this relates also to this podcast, Urbanistica, relates to that we have more and more and larger mega cities with tens of millions of people living very close to each other.
Yeah.
And of course, obviously, that is not very suitable when it comes to the risk for transmission of viruses between cities. And in some countries, we also have these livestock markets, food markets with sometimes animals that are alive and that can transfer viruses to each other and then also further to us humans. So that is probably the most likely explanation to the start of this pandemic in Wuhan, in China, where they had this animal market, food market, with 100,000, I don't know how many animals. And apparently there was a transmission of a virus from an animal to humans and then further transmission between people. So that is something that we need to think about. And how can big cities organize? Can we prepare for these kind of things whenever we plan for how we build more transmission, if it is possible, safe cities?
But is it like, because there are so many scenarios, I love now you make it clear for me, like some people say no, it's from a laboratory, some people say no, it's from an animal, so what is it from?
most likely it's from an animal at this market. Most less likely it was from a laboratory.
Okay. So what are the learnings that we learn apart from like planning cities that at the same time are safe, market, keep it clean and so on? What else?
Yeah, so one key learning is that we don't have the tools to prevent, to understand, to treat and discover new viruses that cross this species barrier from animals to humans. And we don't have the drugs We don't have the antiviral drugs.
Mm.
We don't even have them against normal viruses that causes disease. I mean,
really?
Yeah, yeah. Well, some viruses we have antivirals against, but that is just maybe 1% of all 1% of all known viruses that causes disease in humans.
Wow.
Yeah. So that I think is a key learning, a key observation that we need to have more antiviral drugs against the viruses that we know.
Mm.
But because if we would have that, for example, against the regular coronaviruses, if we would have had them from day zero in this pandemic, we wouldn't have 23,000 deaths in Sweden. We would maybe have like 200, because we would be able to treat all those that died very early in this pandemic.
Mm.
So that is one key learning. And we also need to develop the diagnostic. Healthcare, primary healthcare, elderly centers needs more and better diagnostic to discover virus-caused diseases. And when we have those two things together, we will be able to limit transmission and help healthcare.
Yeah. Can you explain to us why we were like focusing on, not focusing maybe, or we have the drugs to 1% and the 99, we don't have anything to treat?
Yeah. So if we compare, for example, then with bacteria and antibiotics, where we have like broad spectrum antibiotics that can be used for treatment of almost all bacteria, except the resistant. These kind of drugs, we have them because bacteria and fungi, they develop them as chemical weapons when they fight each other in nature.
Okay.
And when we discovered those chemical weapons, we realized, okay, so we can maybe use them for treatment of infections caused by these pathogens. But viruses, they don't fight against each other in nature in the same way. So we haven't had that like for free, sort of. We haven't been able to discover that kind of natural antiviral drug that exists in nature. So that is one reason. Other reasons are like viruses are intracellular parasites. So they go into our cells.
Mm.
And it's first inside our cells that they expose targets for treatments and drugs.
Yeah.
And that makes it challenging to develop this kind of drugs because otherwise they can cause the side effects and be dangerous to us.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why we have so few also, for example. And a third reason is that the viruses are very, very small. So it's hard to hit them, aim at them sort of as compared to other ones.
Yeah.
Finally, we are too few virologists. We need to be more that do research in this area.
Mm. Why there are few researchers? Because like it's not so attractive?
No. I think it's for historical reasons.
Well,
we discovered viruses not too long ago, like maybe just 50 years ago. No, 70 years ago.
Only?
Yeah, yeah. So
it's like nothing compared to humans.
But we didn't have the tools. And so it was like first 70 years ago that we realized that viruses exist in this kind of way.
Mm.
And that we started to develop the model systems to understand them so that we could study them.
Yeah.
And some viruses are still very, very hard to study because we don't have the model systems to do research on them.
So it is very, very new for us.
Yes,
like
exactly.
Comparing to all the human history.
For example, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's like nothing.
No, that's right, yeah. And it takes time to build up a strong research area.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Mm.
So, could you see that, like, there's a big difference between small and big cities when it comes to the cases?
Yes, definitely, of course. So, all these kind of things are relative to populations.
Mm.
So, the more people living in a city, the bigger risk for transmission. More people obviously fall ill in virus-caused diseases. Now, I read that last week, we have a small city in northern Sweden, that is called Sorsele. And for the first time now, they were COVID-free.
Oh.
Yeah. So no COVID in that city.
Yeah.
So that was the first city to be COVID-free now. Okay. So it could be that COVID comes back there, but for the first
time. For
now.
Yeah,
exactly.
So far.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And that is a very small city.
Yeah.
It's like the second smallest city in Sweden.
Yeah. And also, like, if you remember, like, each country had different rules and lockdowns and so on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What we did in Sweden about the mask and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a smart decision? Like nothing was mandatory, right?
Mm, that's right, yeah. When it comes to masks, I think that, okay, so we could probably have been a little bit faster and used the masks to a higher extent, and that would have limited some of the transmission. But the main problem for Sweden in the early phase of the pandemic was that we couldn't really protect the elderly and most vulnerable living at elderly centers.
Mm.
So that was the main problem in Sweden.
Why we couldn't do that? Because of limited resources or?
Yeah, I think so. Partially at least in the way that we organize elderly healthcare here in Sweden. We could not simply prevent the virus from entering the elderly centers.
Yeah.
And when it entered the elderly centers, we could not prevent transmission between people in a good way.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have the tools and the knowledge.
And how is it worldwide now? Is it like, are there some countries, cities still suffering from this?
China.
Still?
Actually, China, they have the main problem right now because they have had this COVID zero strategy for like almost 3 years. And there have been lots of protests because of this, because it has been very, very tough to the people living in China. Now they have lifted these restrictions, so there is no lockdown anymore.
Okay.
Which means that transmission blew up in December.
Again.
Yeah, yeah. So they had super much transmission at that time. And we really don't know how much transmission, how big the problems were, but we can expect that the problems were real.
But is it again like, okay, we are also going to get it? It's just like but how is it happened the first time?
Sorry.
Like, I mean, like now it's blowing up again in China.
Yeah, exactly. Mm.
So does it mean that we are going to get it again?
No,
or?
We already have it.
And that's it.
Yeah, the rest of the world already have it. So the rest of the world doesn't have to be very, very afraid that there will be new variants coming from China that will hit us hard. I think that it may rather be China that have more to fear from new variants popping up maybe here or in other countries that will hit
come
China.
Back.
So they have, in the worst of worlds, then they have a lot of the pandemic ahead of them, whereas we have most of the pandemic behind us.
So what can we like do and prepare to face the coming pandemics? As you mentioned, there will be many more.
Probably lots of things that we can do. Okay, so we knew that we hadn't had stocks of protection equipment here in Sweden. So it was more or less on a day-to-day basis. So we need to have storages with these kind of things. So that's one thing.
Yeah,
we need to perhaps then, I think, centralize healthcare. So the different healthcare organizations, counties and so on, communicate better with each other. That is one thing. And what we can do and contribute with is more research that provides knowledge and tools. And that is like diagnostics, antiviral drugs and vaccines against the viruses that we know of. Because if we develop these tools, then we will be much, much better prepared when we are being hit by another pandemic.
Exactly. And is this like how to prepare for the coming pandemics? Is it different in the different countries? Maybe like, is it the same in Spain and is it the same Brazil or no? What you mentioned specifically for Sweden?
Yeah, so it's probably a little bit different in different countries. I don't know much about other countries, how they prepare. I know that the European Union prepare in a way that they put some effort, some resources into research, for example. So that is something that we do in Europe. I also know that the G7 countries, they have started up something. Something that is called, well, they call it a science dialogue, also relating to the need of antiviral drugs. We have the G20 countries and the World Health Organization that has started something that they also call Pandemic Foundation, like we do, with the same aim. So there are global efforts and there are national efforts that that will help us to be better prepared.
Yeah. And what can we do as planners, architects working with the city? What should we think about when we plan now?
I think that there are some things that actually can be done. Looking out now at the office landscape that you have here, that is like, I think it is, it gives me a feeling that it's a nice place to work at, but it's like open and with quite a lot of air.
True.
And whenever, I don't know about the ventilation and things like that, but I fear that when we have this kind of landscape, there will be possibilities for transmission. And we are like social creatures. So I understand, I would like to work here rather than working in my old laboratory where we will sit in like one-to-one more
in a box.
Yeah, but perhaps it is that we can design offices with ventilation so that air is being transported, not between people, but more, as much as possible at least, away from people.
Ah.
So if there is these kind of things, I think they may be useful. So that is one thing.
Yeah.
And there are also, I've understood, sort of air cleaners that can be put, that filter the air.
Yeah.
And they can also pick up viruses.
Mm.
So that is one thing that can be used in different environments. Another thing that can be done, I think, is that we know that viruses, they transmit more efficiently when the indoor air is dry.
Yes.
As compared to when the air is humid.
Mm.
So I know also that there are these kind of tools that humidifies the air.
True.
So perhaps these kind of things. Okay, so we don't want to sit indoor and be like wet. But perhaps there's a possibility to balance this to some extent. Because if the air is more humid, then this will like take care of viruses that transmit in the air and make them fall down to the ground.
Mm. And how about the outdoor?
Outdoor, I don't know if it will be possible to... Yeah, okay, so when it comes to public transport, buses and things like this, for example, I guess one can think of it in the same way there, to perhaps design, organize ventilation in some way.
Mm.
So that the air flows, don't go between people.
But like...
Yeah, perhaps away from people to a high extent than what it is like today. But I guess also that it will be challenging. I don't think that there will be possibilities to have train wagons, for example, where people only sit by themselves, locked up more or less in a small little cabin.
You don't know the engineers. They can do it.
Yeah. Hopefully.
So the main element is the air that shouldn't be between me and you, more than between me and the machine sucking it up.
Yeah. So that's the main element. But we also have this kind of transmission that occurs between with contact. So here I think that we have learned a lot here, because we are using alcohol to prevent and kill viruses that we have on our hands and on surfaces. So that is something that has been much better here, at least in Sweden, probably other countries also.
Mm.
So that limits some of the contact transmission.
Well, and you mentioned like the animals in the markets and so on.
Mm.
I know like some countries, they have it as a culture.
Yes.
Then you cannot just like ban all these kind of markets. But
no. How
can we make it better, like, in your opinion? Like, is it same method as the air thing or?
Yeah. So I guess it's a mixture of indoor and outdoor markets where they have the animals.
Yeah.
So if it would be indoor, we can maybe do the things that we just talked about. If it is outdoor, it will be more difficult. Perhaps if animals will be locked up in small cages, perhaps they could be like glass cages.
The main point is to separate each single animal.
Yeah, yeah, if that is possible.
Mm-hmm.
And prevent transmission between them and from them to humans.
Those like green areas between buildings, like parks, helps to lower the cases?
I think so, yeah. Because if people can walk between, I mean, yeah, and every time we are outdoor, the risk for transmission is less as compared to when we are indoors. So more space between people in general, parks, things like that for sure will help.
Mm. So because like you're keeping people away, like in a distance between.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's how you lower down the chances of the transition.
Yeah. Yeah. Population density is a key thing. I think we have areas around the world, big cities where people living on top of each other, and whenever one person is falling ill, the chances of transmission is much higher.
Mm-hmm.
So here in northern Sweden, where I live, it's a city with about 140,000 people. So of course we have like public transport, buses and so on, and there can be transmission. And of course we have schools with 30 pupils, for example, that will be there can be transmission there also.
Mm.
But I think that we are not living as crowded there as in some other countries, super densely populated countries and cities, for example. So there are the risk for transmission higher as compared to when people live not as close to each other.
Good for you, no?
Yeah, it's a little bit. I like Northern Sweden for many reasons. Yeah. No, this is not the main reason. There are so many one other good reasons. Yeah, yeah.
How, what do you think about, like, because we saw there were like a field hospitals and then army turned to be like a hospital. What do you think about this kind of temporary infrastructure?
Good. So whenever we are hit by a threat, like we were 3 years ago, these possibilities to build emergency hospitals is super important.
Mm.
So if we have that kind of preparation and that kind of capacity, that will for sure help.
Yeah.
I don't think that the regular hospitals can have that kind of buffer with empty beds to be prepared like for this kind of thing, because the healthcare is already having a very tough
overloaded situation.
Exactly.
Yeah. You mentioned also like about like the elderly care. You mentioned that the way we have it or we build it, we couldn't stop. Like, can you elaborate more?
I think so, yeah. So I think that in Sweden, we don't have the stuff, healthcare stuff, sufficient numbers of healthcare stuff in relation to all the elderly people that live there.
Yeah.
So I think that if it would be more healthcare personnel being around there, doctors, nurses, and so on, that would be useful.
Yeah.
And if there would be more diagnostic around there to test different people whenever they fall ill so that one can have a quick diagnosis, then there will be possible to isolate them and treat them and prevent transmission.
Yeah.
So Norway, I think Finland, probably Denmark also, did it much better than we did early in the pandemic. So here Sweden has something to work with.
Yeah. So with all the different points you mentioned, but like having a space in the city is very important.
Yes.
Mm.
I would say so, yeah.
In between buildings.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So now we are like 8 billion people living on our planet, and we have never been that many before. So of course I understand that there are mega cities and big cities being formed, population density increases, but that is not sustainable for future.
Yes.
I don't think so.
So like you mentioned also like there will be more pandemics.
Mm.
Is it something like going to happen now or in the coming years? Do we know when and what and how?
No, we don't know. In the best of world, it will take decades before we are being hit by another pandemic again. But I fear that it will be sooner than that. And that is because we are becoming more and more people on Earth, and we are traveling more than ever. We are shoveling rainforest and so on. So, and the biological diversity is having a tough time. So all together, I fear that it will be rather that we will have more outbreaks caused by virus. This feels so depressing to say, but I think that we have to talk about it and the threats.
We have to.
We have to, yeah. Mm. So if it is that the World Health Organization has announced 7 global public health emergency situations during the latest 14 years, I think that we will have to count on that happening in future also. Mm. And we don't know what kind of health emergency that will develop into a pandemic.
Yeah.
But we know that viruses is the main cause of this emergency. So we need to prepare for it.
Yeah.
We don't know which virus that will cause the next pandemic either. So we have had like 4 influenza virus caused pandemics during the latest 100 years.
Mm.
We have had 2 outbreaks and 1 pandemic being caused by coronaviruses.
Mm.
So we will be able probably to take care of these kind of outbreaks and pandemics in a sufficient way, in a good way now, because we have the tools and the knowledge. But the next pandemic can be caused by almost any other virus. And we don't know then if the mRNA-based vaccines will be our rescue or if we would need other tools.
Yeah. So like one of the main reasons is that we are damaging the planet or the ecosystem, and then we are traveling a lot or we are exchanging a lot.
Mm.
And that's how we exchange also viruses somehow.
Yeah, so the biological diversity suffers these days. So more and more animals, insects, and so on is being called exterminated, which means that it's hard to explain this in a good way. But I think that altogether, the risks for these kind of zoonotic events when viruses transfer from animals to humans increases.
Mm.
Oh, sorry, what? Can you repeat the question again?
The question was like, we're damaging the ecosystem.
Yeah.
We're getting more population.
Mm.
And that's increased the chances of us exchanging viruses.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Short answer is yes.
Yeah. So, like, the next pandemic, if there will be something that we familiar to us, like a virus familiar to us, we're gonna survive somehow.
Or
at least not the same damage as we got.
Well, the risk, if it would be another virus, like something called close to the RS virus, something called close to polio, for example, viruses that we know of, but and that we can handle fairly well these days, thanks to that we have vaccines against polio, for example. But if, for example, if it would be a new polio virus, a cousin to polio virus, I think that could be, in the worst of worlds, that situation would be worse. That could be worse than this pandemic.
Mm.
But it depends on the transmission efficiency, for example, and some other parameters. And I don't think that we can foresee and say how it will be, what kind of virus that will cause the next pandemic. We just know that it will happen. And if we learn more about the viruses that we know of, then we will be better prepared.
Yeah. But are countries and leaders prepared and taking these seriously? Like, as you mentioned, the World Health Organization announced the different, what do you call it?
They started something called the Pandemic Foundation together with the G20 countries.
Yeah.
So that is a good thing.
Yeah. And you mentioned there are like 14 different, not viruses, what did you call?
We have like 30 different virus families. With all in all hundreds of viruses that we know cause disease in humans.
Mm-hmm.
And in nature, there are thousands of other viruses that we don't know of, probably belonging to these families that we know of, cousins and so on, but we haven't really isolated. So there are thousands of viruses out there in nature that may potentially cross the species barrier and cause outbreak.
So my question is, are governments taking this seriously and taking care and preparing or not? It's like, not really.
So they're taking some precautions. I wish that there would be more precautions and efforts put into this than it has been. Mm. So some things are has improved. But all in all, I fear that it is insufficient. Okay. And that is why we start the Virus and Pandemic Foundation, because I think more efforts are needed.
Yeah. And how is it now in Sweden? Are we safe? Can we celebrate? Are we done?
Almost.
Almost?
Yeah. So we still have quite a number of deaths here in Sweden associated with COVID. So some people still die from COVID. Some people die with COVID.
Okay.
So they have been like infected with coronaviruses, but they die for other reasons.
Mm.
So COVID is still here with us and it will be with us. We cannot extinguish, we cannot kill the virus and get rid of it. That is impossible. So we will live with COVID as we live with influenza virus, for example. In future.
Mm. But also there was a lot of debate, I think, still about the vaccine and should we take it, should we not, and should we trust them, should we not?
So it feels like internet is both good and bad. YouTube is wonderful, wonderful to watch it, but I also feel a little bit that there is like a parallel world being developed when people fabricate ideas, hypotheses and so on. That is not based on fact, that is not based on evidence and science, and that scares me a little bit.
Yeah,
because that is dangerous. I would wish that people talk to each other more and lean towards science, lean towards authorities, governments in good countries. Now I just generalize and say good countries. So in Sweden we have this In US it's called the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, that like approves vaccines and drugs and so on. We have that in Sweden also. So I trust them. So if they approve a vaccine, if they approve a new drug, then I trust them. So this is something that is good, sufficiently good. And I wish that more people would trust governments and science in general.
So it's a question of trust.
I think so, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. But I also understand, okay, so we have some examples of big pharma companies that do bad things that are questioned. Like we have the Oxy thing in USA, for example.
What's it?
OxyContin, this opium-like drug that was prescribed to lots of people that didn't need, and many of them became addicted.
Oh, yeah.
So that is a big thing. And that was like a scandal.
Mm.
A really, really bad thing that inhibited trust for FDA and Big Pharma, for example. So we need to be careful here. But I also think that there are so many authorities, so much in science, and also so much good in Big Pharma industry. Mm. So I wish that we could have some more trust in people and companies that wants to do good things.
Yeah. So before we close this episode, so tell me what kind of research you do now and what is the next?
Yeah, so the research that I do now is to understand how viruses enter cells.
Okay.
Yeah, because if we understand this step in more detail, then we would understand why some viruses hit the eyes, why some viruses hit the gut, why some viruses hit the respiratory tract, for example, why some other viruses hit the nervous system and brain.
Yeah.
So that is one thing that can come out of it. And another thing is that we then can also identify targets for antiviral drugs. That's another thing. Finally, we know also that viruses can be good. We can actually exploit viruses. Take this example, for example. So we know that cancer is a situation when cells divide uncontrolled. And we also know that viruses can kill cells. So what if we could design viruses that specifically kill cancer cells?
Okay.
That would be awesome, right?
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah. But how do you do that? How do you study it? Do you have like machines, I don't know, like
microscopes, for example, and we have like cancer cells that we use as a tool to so we can like isolate cancer cells.
Wow.
Cancer cells are excellent tools for virologists.
Wow.
So we have like hundreds of different cancer types in our laboratory. Fortunately, cancer is not transmitting between people, so we don't have to be afraid that we would get cancer just by working with cancer cells. But we use them as tools to cultivate viruses, to grow viruses, to study viruses, and to see how they, for example, enter cells using microscopes and lots of molecular biology technologies, such as PCR, for example, that I think that most people know.
But do we have advanced technology for your research, or no, you're still struggling? Like you say, I wish we had this tool. I wish we had this kind of microscope.
Yeah, we have. I think today now we have far more better tools than we had when I started, as compared to when I started. Say, for example, as 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Say, for example, the developments in, it's called cryo-electron microscopy.
Mm.
So now we can look at viruses in microscope and almost identify every single atom in an entire virus.
Whoa.
Yeah, that is awesome. That is fantastic.
Yeah.
We can look at them and see how they, I can show you a picture later.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, so that is super cool. So that also helps us in our efforts to understand what kind of how to design antivirals and vaccines for.
So is this your full-time job now?
Yes.
And how many are you in the team now?
Like 10.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so I have like two, three PhD students, some postdocs, people that have defended their PhD, and some engineers.
Yeah.
Great team. So fun to work with people.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, research is fantastic in general, and we can like employ people from everywhere around the world.
Yeah, nowadays.
Yeah, so that's so great. People coming from other countries telling us their stories, how they live and about their culture. So that's fantastic.
That's amazing.
I feel privileged.
Yeah, yeah. So now we are in the end of this episode. Three questions. The first one is that you give a message to yourself.
Yeah, okay. So I think that I need to take better care of myself. The last 3 years I haven't. I have gained weight, so I need to train a little bit more. I feel that I have to work on myself, sleeping better, eat better, and so on. So that is something that I need to do for myself.
Yeah, the pandemic is over, so now you can rest.
Yeah, almost, yeah. I look forward to that a little bit more.
And the second question is that you give three takeaway messages to our listeners.
Then the first one is related to what we talked about when it comes to fake news and things like that. I think that it's a great thing that we have so many opinions, but I also feel that there are so many opinions and too few people that listen to each other. I think that we need to be a little bit better at listening to each other, what other people have to say and so on. So I'm being contacted by people that sometimes spread fake news, in my opinion, but I listen to them. I would like to understand their situation, their point of view, and I discuss with them and try to be open-minded. I think also that I can learn from other people by listening. So that is one thing.
Yeah.
And another thing is try to see everything that is positive. in our world rather than negative things. So if we have a more positive mindset, and if we believe in future, if we believe in ourselves and everything that we can do, that will help us. Sometimes I think that media just loves to blow up conflicts and everything that is bad in our world. But there's so much things that are good also. So let's see that to a larger extent than previously. And finally, I think that we can we can contribute, even though we are just one out of 8 billion people in the world. I think that every single one of us can contribute to make the world better if we just do some small things. For example, when I take out my dog for a walk, I sometimes bring a plastic bag and I pick up garbage. Okay, so maybe it will not do much all in all, but a little bit. So if there are many of us that think more positive and do a little thing here and there, that will make a difference.
Yeah. Like if you do 1%, I do 1%. Exactly. My neighbor do 1%.
Yeah.
We collect all these together. In the end, we are doing a huge amount of
definitely
change.
Yeah. So let's be optimistic here and believe in ourselves that we can make a difference.
Let's do that. So the final question is going to be you asking it to me and to our listeners. So what is your question to us?
So, okay, may I ask you to, okay, that's right, to reflect on. So we talked about, I formulated more, not a question, but a statement.
More like,
can I
of
come
course.
Up with a,
do what makes you happy.
Yeah, thank you. So one thing that I would like and encourage people to reflect about is that the thing that we talked about, the World Health Organization has announced no less than 7 global public health emergencies in the latest 14 years. And all of them has been caused by virus. Why is it like this? And I think that reflect about also that, okay, so we are 8 billion people in the world today. And we travel more than ever. And altogether, this means that there will be increased risk for transmission. So let's think about these things, and because these are major threats to humanity. So all of us, I think, needs to consider this a little bit and think about what we are doing and take care of each other in a way that we really can be better.
Well, Niklas, thank you so much. I'm really inspired and I learn a lot by this talk. I want to say I will be happy to see, but I will not be happy to talk about another pandemic. So hopefully we're going to meet and find out about your research, but not to talk about new pandemics.
Yeah, maybe better talk about the tools that we develop that will prevent them.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.